Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Neil Stavem. I always appreciate the opportunity to get together and have a good conversation. And today will be one of those times when we get to talk with a best-selling author about a wonderful new book that really will enrich us, I think, today. You hear Eric Metaxas on regularly on Breakpoint. He splits those duties with John Stonestreet. And I'm always fascinated to hear the conversations, the commentary that happens there. But Eric has just completed a new book, and we're honored to have him on with us today. He is, among other things, not just a best-selling author, but he actually does a syndicated radio program as well. And so we're able to connect with him before his show goes on. But Eric's a best-selling author of Miracles, Bonhoeffer, Seven Men, Amazing Grace, more than 30 other books. And he was a keynote speaker at the 2012 National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. We're going to refer to that a little bit later in our conversation. He speaks to tens of thousands around the United States and internationally each year. He's a senior fellow and lecturer at large at King's College in New York City, where he lives with his wife and daughter. And we're going to talk about the new book, Seven Women and the Secret of Their Greatness. Eric Metaxas, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you for having me. Great to be with you and your audience.
We talked, I think it was several years ago when the book Seven Men came out. And
yes,
so
right.
I guess we should probably ask at the outset, was this something where the women who read that book said, well, you're missing half the story and you should do something on women?
Yeah, there was a lot of nagging that led to this book. Just kidding. No, I tell you the truth, it flowed quite naturally out of it, because I'm aware of, as some people know who are listening, that I've written all these biographies. I wrote the biography of Bonhoeffer, it's like 600 pages, and I wrote the biography of William Wilberforce, and I continue to come upon amazing stories of amazing lives, and I know that when you share those stories, people's lives are touched and changed. It is inevitable. I cannot tell you how many people come up to me and say that I read this story, I read that book, and it changed my life. Now, it's not that my book changed the life. It's the story of a human being who actually lived the person who lived that life changed that person's life. But I had the joy of writing about it, and I have so many stories. And so I said, I can't write so many biographies, but I can do shorter versions of them. So I wrote Seven Men, and I, of course, had so many other names in my head, and I thought it would make perfect sense to write Seven Women. So yeah, it just came out. It's doing really well. And the introductions to both books are important as much as the seven biographies within the book, because I talk about what is it to be a man and what is it to be a woman? What makes a man great and what makes a woman great? And they're sort of different things, as you would guess. And I talk about that, and I think it's important to frame the conversation that we're not all alike, that God makes us different, individually different, but also different. Men and women are inherently different, and the way they express greatness is inherently different. So it's right that I didn't just say, seven great people.
Yeah, well, before we start diving into some of those wonderful stories, let's take that introduction a little bit deeper, because it does seem like there's maybe a lot of angst or unrest among at least ardent feminists about women's issues and values today. And, one could look at their philosophy and say maybe it's not always so coherent. So how would you define the state of women in America today around the globe? And maybe what is it that are the important issues of greatness in women?
Well, that's really what I write about in the introduction, is this idea that sometimes contemporary feminism has pitted men against women and women against men, and that really brings everybody down. That's what I try to say. In other words, if you look at male greatness, the fake example of greatness, right, the sort of the chest-beating, macho, whatever, that's not God's idea of greatness. That's a really fallen, broken view of greatness. Me, 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 and I think that what happens typically in a fallen culture is that women who have been hurt by that version of manhood, really it's fake manhood, respond in kind and say, well, they have power and they're oppressing me, so I need to get power, And it becomes like, so we're all after the same bad thing. The problem with men who have power and misusing it and misuse it is not that they have power, it's that they're misusing it. God has given them what he's given them to use for others, specifically for women. Men are meant to protect women and to bless women. And the idea that, you know, the culture tells us, no, all power is bad. It's the same as if, you know, you say our country is too strong and we're harming other countries. Well, the problem is if we have strength and wealth, as America does, we're meant to use it to bless other countries. So it's not that we should get weaker. It's that we should simply use our strength for the right things. That's the issue. And so people who think that America needs to be brought down a notch have it all wrong. Similarly, women who think men need to be brought down a notch have it all wrong, because if men would simply use what it is they have to bless women instead of to abuse them or to use them, you know, then everything would be as it should be. And I talk about how in the women's book, Seven Women, I talk about how the greatness of these seven women stems directly from their being women. In other words, it's not from copying men, that each of them expresses their femininity in a certain way that is really beautiful, and it's what makes them who they are. And so it's important for women to lean into being a woman and not sort of simply try to imitate men.
If men, their challenge, their God-given assignment to protect and bless, what would you say are there some equal assignments for women?
Well, I don't really think of it that way, or I didn't really think of it that way. I think, you know, at the end of the day, all of it is about faithfulness to God and to God's calling. That's really what it boils down to. You know, it's not about winning. It's about being faithful to God's calling on our lives. You know, so I have a calling to be a husband and a father and to do a number of things. And I can't compare myself to other people. Everyone is different. Not everybody's called to be a father just because he's a man or a husband or whatever. We have to really look at our own lives and really determine God's particular calling on each of us. And that goes for women. And so the seven women I've chosen for the book Seven Women are quite different. I think that only one of them is a so-called housewife, and I put her in there just to show that a so-called housewife can absolutely change the world dramatically. I mean, it's what a story. That's the story of Susanna Wesley. But there's so many different types in the Seven Men book and in the Seven Women book. You really get a smorgasbord of types to choose from, and you start realizing, well, you know, maybe I'm like this and I'm not like that. I can admire that, but that's not my calling in life to be like that. So I think that ultimately these things come from a relationship with God, where we simply pray, say, Lord, show me what you want me to do. Show me what you have for me. And so these stories give us examples and ideas, and we always need that. But at the end of all things, we have to come face to face with God and say, what do you have for me to do? Maybe it's something that, you know, has no cognate in this world or in history. Maybe it's something new. So I think we can learn a lot from these stories, but at the heart of it all, you see that each of these men and each of these women had a unique calling. And so you learn from that as much as I want to be like George Washington say, I want to be like somebody else. Like he had to understand who he was. And so that's part of what makes each of these figures great.
Well, I think we've set up a good tease here for the rest of our conversation. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and dive into more of this wonderful new book from Eric Metaxas, Seven Women and the Secret of Their Greatness. And you may be already making a list in your mind. All right, who would be on that list? We'll see how it compares with what Eric has written. Eric Metaxas, author of the best-selling books Amazing Grace, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About God But Were Afraid to Ask, Everything Else You've Always Wanted to Know About God, and 30 children's books. He's founder and host of Socrates in the City in New York City, and he writes regularly. And, of course, you hear him on Breakpoint regularly as well. He's also hosts a nationally syndicated radio program, and we're honored to have him with us today on Connecting Faith, and we'll get to more in just a moment. Stay tuned. Well, it's 15 past the hour, talking today with Eric Metaxas about his brand new book called Seven Women and the Secret of Their Greatness. Of course, he had this wonderful book, Seven Men, that came out couple of years ago, or maybe it was less than that, portraying some of history's greatest men, and now he is taking a look at some amazing women. And we're going to find out about the secret of their greatness. And maybe just say a word, Eric, about that before we dive in. Greatness, we think of, you know, in today's culture, there's notoriety, there's fame, you know, maybe even heroic or historic. But what were you looking for? What kind of characteristics were you looking for when you started putting this together?
Well, that's exactly why I wrote these books, because I said that the real issue is that in this day and age, we do not have great role models in the culture. I think you look around the culture and you have many bad role models. There are a few good ones here and there. We get glimpses, but by and large, we have a lot of bad role models. And I think we've seen the reason I wrote the Seven Men book, what started it all, I said, is what are we telling young men in particular about what does it mean to be a man? Do we talk about that anymore? We get these false messages and these false choices, right? On the one hand, you can be a sort of chest beating, you know, spiking the ball in the end zone, me kind of, you know, bravado filled macho character, which is really a nothing but a boy, you know, a boy on steroids, or you can be this fae, kind of asexual creature that, you know, I don't want to be too manly. I the whole idea of manhood, what is manhood? You know, it doesn't really mean anything anymore. And I think those are false choices. I think that in the middle someplace is somebody who is, you know, a gentleman, somebody who uses his strength for others, who's a hero. And I think we all want our fathers to be heroes. And, you know, we need to put those examples, those characters out there. And so the Seven Men in the Seven Men book, really, I said principally I want young men to get seven pictures of seven lives that are great, that God would say, in my estimation, that God would say that they're great, and also for young women to read about what makes a great man, so when they choose a husband, they're thinking about those kinds of qualities. And I thought of the same thing, as I say, for Seven Women, that young women today, what kind of messages are they getting about what does it mean to be a woman? Very mixed messages. I think sometimes, oftentimes, getting really negative, messed up kind of messages. And I said, these are seven women that are so great that when you just come in contact with the story, you cannot help but feel drawn to wanting to be a better person. And so I really did put these out as examples. And so, it's, I mean, they're not just for young people, but I think that oftentimes people, you know, buy them to give to a young person in their life. The writing is much simpler than in my Bonhoeffer or Wilberforce books. It's not all that simple, but it's definitely something that, you know, you could give to a 15-year-old and not worry about it. But it's to really boil it down to the qualities, that gets tougher. But I think really living for others, what the New Testament calls agape love, to live for others, to sacrifice yourself for others. The irony is we can only be our truest selves when we're living for others. God created us, you know, to live for others. It doesn't mean we become doormats. Of course not. But ultimately, that's why we're here, is to bless others and to serve others with what we have. And I would say that the seven characters in each book represent that virtue.
Well, speaking of, I guess, young girls and role models, probably couldn't do much better than young Joan of Arc. We go way back to the 1400s. Say a bit more about, tell us about her amazing life. And, you know, not many of us know much about, we don't remember history too well.
Well, I have to say, the story of Joan of Arc is one of the wildest, most extraordinary stories I have ever encountered. And the thing is, you know, all of the characters in these two books, everything is documented. This is not like if I'm writing about, you know, Esther from the Bible or something where we have very little biographical detail and documentation. The story of Joan of Arc, even though it happens in the early 1400s, we have tremendous documentation. We have her whole trial, the transcript of her trial. And so you look at this life and you say, this really happened. This is history. And yet it's a crazy story. It's about a farm girl who is living in France, who the family's very holy, very devout. They're praying all the time, going to church all the time. And she starts hearing voices speaking to her, and it's the voice of a number of heavenly figures, angels, and you know, and you you start thinking, well, is that biblical, first of all? You know, like, what is that? I mean, Catholics have no problem with that, but some evangelicals would say, that sounds a little strange to me. But, you know, it's kind of like when Jesus goes up on the Mount of Transfiguration and he's talking to Moses and Elijah. It's when Mary is visited by the angel who talks to her. You know, these things, angels speak to people. And so the question is, are you crazy or is it real? Well, in the case of Joan of Arc, you get the impression that this was very real, and they keep speaking to her, and they're encouraging her to do something which sounds absolutely nuts, which is to lead an army. Now, this is a simple peasant girl who is feminine. She's not some butch soldier type. This is a feminine girl, devout, prayerful girl, being told that it's her destiny to visit the leaders of France and to compel them to give her an army to lead France back to victory, to restore the rightful king of France. I mean, it sounds like something made up, but history tells us this is exactly what happened, down to every battle and who died and all the details. And the most amazing thing of all is that everything that she said came to pass, that this is, you know, some people who understand that you can have a prophetic gift. There are people who hear from God, and what they say comes to pass. That's a prophetic gift, and we get many bad versions of that, but it's the real thing when God is in it. And her story is a story of somebody being led to do that, and then, of course, the very tragic ending of her life, being captured by the English and then ultimately burnt at the stake for heresy, when it was it's very clear that she was the opposite of a heretic. She was, in fact, a saint. The Roman Catholic Church sainted her eventually, and the people who tried her and who burnt her at the stake were all either excommunicated or branded heretics themselves. They were people just doing things because they wanted to do things. They used the authority of the church, but the church eventually turned on them and said, no, they were wrong. They were absolutely wrong. So it's a beautiful story of a young woman. I think there's really nothing like it. And I said, I've just got to put her in there because so many people don't know the story.
The early apostles, when they were teaching in Jerusalem, and the religious leaders were saying these were unschooled men, and she was a peasant girl, had no formal training, and yet God used her in a mighty way.
Oh yeah, very mighty. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it seems like this, and you also focus on Susanna Wesley, that and really maybe even throughout all the stories that you cover, that there was a fair amount of religious strife underway during, I guess we think philosophical religious battles going on today, but this has been going on for centuries, hasn't it, where there's this tension between the established church and those trying to follow God's leading.
I think that's kind of the standard story through history, is that you have people who ultimately use the church for their own ends, and then a holy remnant rises up and decides to sort of try to represent the true faith in the midst of that Pharisaism, and you've got figures throughout church history doing that. And in Susanna Wesley's time, we take for granted that we have religious freedom in this country, but imagine living in a country like England where they said you must worship the same way that the king worships, and then the king says yes, and we're going to enforce that, and if you don't do that, we will throw you in jail, and that people, because of their conscience, saying I cannot do that, that is not right, and then going to jail and suffering. And of course many of them came to this country to escape that oppression. But Susanna Wesley, in the middle of the 18th century, it was they kept switching kings and allegiances, and you really had to know what you believe, because it would matter to how you'd be treated, and you'd have to pay a price. And so she, that's part of her story in a way, but ultimately the story is about how she raises her children. Her 10 children, the father was a minister, but he was traveling a lot, so she really raised them mostly on her own. And she taught them Bible studies. She was just a genius. She wrote textbooks. She pretty much homeschooled them, so she's really the mother of homeschooling. And she did such a great job that two of her sons, John Wesley and Charles Wesley, you know, became the leaders of what became known as Methodism, the Wesleyan Revival. And that changed England and ultimately changed the world. And they would have never done that if their mother, Susanna Wesley, had not raised them in the way that she did. She poured herself into these children, and it absolutely changes the world. You wouldn't get William Wilberforce without the Wesleyan Revival. I mean, all of history would be different. And so the history was changed dramatically because of one mother being faithful in her calling, pouring her life into her kids. It's really a magnificent story and a magnificent example of what one life can do.
Of course, the Wesleys were accused of being methodical, but Susanna certainly exhibited that in her home life, didn't she? She was a very organized, disciplined woman.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Of course, today she'd be criticized as a neat freak, as a you know, obsessive compulsive, probably. But you know, when you got 10 kids running around, you may need a little of that sometimes. But she got the job done. It's pretty amazing. It is amazing. Oh, it's funny actually, and I put some of the funny stuff in the book. People who know me know I like to kid around, but you can't help but laugh at the foibles of the great and famous. You know that even at their best, there's something funny about them because they're so who they are. You know, she was really extremely strict, not at all cruel or anything, but it's, you know, just very, very strict. But it seems to have worked incredibly well. You don't get the impression that the kids grew up warped by in any way. On the contrary, they bloomed beautifully. So it's it really is that's a lesson for us who think that we've got to be careful not to be too strict. I mean, you can also be too lenient, and that can harm kids in other ways.
Susanna Wesley is story number two of seven women, the seven women and their secret to greatness. We touched on Joan of Arc and Susanna Wesley. There's five more to go. We're going to try and get through all of those and draw some lessons and some conclusions as we go through that. Talking today with Eric Metaxas. Eric is a best-selling author, books like Miracles, Bonhoeffer, Amazing Grace, Seven Men, and this was sort of a counter to that. It's just to look at some great role models for women as well, and you'll find these stories compelling. He also hosts the Eric Metaxas Show. It's a nationally syndicated radio show, and you hear him on Breakpoint regularly. He was also the keynote speaker at the 2012 National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. We're going to reference that a bit later as well, because there's some connection there to one of the stories that he covers. And we'd love to have you join the conversation. If maybe there's a question, maybe you've already picked up a copy or you know a little bit about it and you want to just weigh in or just say Merry Christmas to Eric, you're welcome to do that. We'll open up the phone lines momentarily at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And more with Eric Metaxas in just a moment. Stay tuned. Here we are on Connecting Faith, and we've connected with Eric Metaxas today, best-selling author, radio host. You hear him on Breakpoint regularly with John Stone Street each morning here on Faith Radio, and I hope you make a point to listen to that. And I hope you've read some of his many books. Wonderful writer, maybe perhaps best known for Bonhoeffer. That was such an amazing story, and he's also written Miracles that came out not too long ago. We talked to him a couple of years ago when Seven Men came out, and he's written, I guess you could maybe say, a companion to that, only the books stand on their own. This is called Seven Women and the Secret of Their Greatness, and we're reviewing some of those that he's chosen to highlight. And Eric, obviously you didn't have time to write full biographies. Were there some things that you specifically tried to include or maybe that you knew you'd have to exclude?
I think that I said everything I wanted to say about these folks. It's an interesting dynamic because I didn't feel like, oh, there's so much more here, which is a good feeling if you're a writer. That's very frustrating sometimes. When I was writing the Wilberforce book and when I was writing the Bonhoeffer book, I kept thinking, oh, there's so much I want to put in, so much more I want to put in. But I think I try to keep them bite-sized, and that's one of the reasons I think they're much more readable than the Bonhoeffer or the Wilberforce, both of which I think are very readable because I keep hearing that. But I think if you're not somebody who's going to dive into a 300 or 500 page book, I wanted to tell, you know, sort of the guts of the story. What, who is this person in 9,000 words, you know? And it's a chapter. But I didn't ever feel that, no. And I'm very happy, as I say, to say that, because that's so frustrating for a writer when you think, oh, I wish I could put this in. But, you know, I was able to make it work.
You know, just say a word maybe personally about, you know, what is it about biographies that you find so enjoyable? Maybe, and are there some, for all of us, I mean, are there some lessons, some things we can learn? Are they instructive to us, or should they be?
Well, I think the thing about biographies, as I was saying earlier, is that you cannot help but be influenced by the lives of other people. That's how God created us, that we're created in his image, and he, you know, he was incarnated as a human being. Human beings matter. It's not just, you know, reading bullet points or somebody telling you. You've got to see it somehow. And so when you hear the story of a life, it affects you. And I was saying earlier that so many people have come up to me and said to me that this story changed my life, that story changed my life. It's inevitable that we are changed by the people we hang out with, the people whose lives we're exposed to. That's just the way human beings are. And I think we're exposed to so many bad examples that when you read these good examples, it touches you, it changes you, it inspires you. That's as it's meant to be. And this is nothing I invented. I mean, this goes all the way back to Plutarch's Lives. I mean, that telling the stories of great people has meant, has been important, has been understood as important for an incredibly long time. It's just the way we're built.
Sure. Well, we've touched a little bit on Joan of Arc and Susanna Wesley, more on Wesley, but also you talk about Hannah More. But it seems like, you know, these were strong women that, and it seemed like it always, they face tension as they encounter men unwilling to share leadership. What lessons might we learn from these women who had, you know, every justification to be strong in their convictions?
Well, I mean, I don't think that they were overbearing, you know, that they were strong in the right way. And, you know, not everybody's called to be strong in that way. Some of us, you know, communicate much more gently. And so it depends who you're talking about in this book. Mother Teresa was a fiery figure. I mean, it's just an incredible thing. You know, she knew what she was doing. And, you know, she was 4'10" and she's marching around and, you know, creating amazing things. What a legacy. It is sort of funny how some of them, they knew what was right and what was wrong, and they represented it with passion. And I think that, yeah, of course, you're going to rub people the wrong way, particularly in an especially patriarchal society as most of these women lived in. I mean, imagine Joan of Arc, a kid, not just a woman, but practically a kid, telling generals and, you know, high figures in government that this is, you know, what God said and this is what we're going to do. And you just it's actually funny in many cases. I find it funny, at least. And Susanna Wesley, you know, getting in arguments over, is she preaching on the Sabbath? She would read the sermons that her husband had written or others had written. She would read them, and so many people came to hear her because the sermons at church were really boring when somebody was replacing her husband. Whoever was replacing her husband in the church was not so good. So people would come to her house to hear her read sermons. And, of course, the pastor is losing, you know, numbers on Sunday, so he gets in this big fight with her, and she gets, you know, goes back and forth in letters with her husband. Is this the right thing for her to be doing? And it's life, right? It's what we all go through. But it's comical when you encounter these strong figures that they knew what they were doing mattered, and they weren't about to, you know, just fold up and say, okay.
One of the names that you write about said that when you were writing your book on Wilberforce, you discovered Hannah More, and thankfully there's an amazing story for her. And tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, Hannah More, I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about writing longer biographies is you get the chance to explore things. And so I bump into this character, Hannah More, and I thought, what an amazing figure. So I wrote about three pages about her in my Wilberforce book, but I thought, gosh, I hope somebody writes a whole biography of her. And someone did. I mentioned it in my chapter, Fierce Convictions is the title of a book by Karen Swallow Pryor, who teaches in the English department at Liberty. Beautiful book about Hannah Moore. But if you want the short version, in my book I write about her. And Hannah Moore was a colleague of Wilberforce's. She was somebody who basically was became friends with Wilberforce and was really his one of his closest colleagues in the abolition abolitionist movement. She was a great writer, a famous writer. Her novels outsold Jane Austen's 10-to-1, and she was known as a poet. And she decides to use her skills in culture to help the abolitionist movement. Wilberforce, of course, used his skills in the legislature as a politician. So you need both. And in our culture, I think Christians have realized, okay, we need to be involved in politics. You know, we figured that out in 1980, but we've neglected culture. And I think we're beginning to figure that out because culture is upstream of politics, and you've got to affect cultural leaders. And Hannah Moore was very influential in that. She wrote a number of poems in those days. Poems were, of course, very popular, and she wrote a poem about slavery, which was very important in winning, the hearts and minds of the people of Great Britain at a time when that was important for the vote.
Interesting. You know, she used poetry and writing and really influenced her world. Is there a medium that carries the day for public opinion today? I mean, and can we, could someone still have that level of influence like a Hannah Moore did, centuries ago?
Oh, I think absolutely. And again, everything changes. I mean, today, I would say people in the media have a lot more leverage than people, let's say, writing novels. But it depends on the novel. It depends on, it really depends, generally speaking, on the specifics. But I do believe that what Christians have neglected is the culture. We ought to be involved in the cultural conversation. We ought to bring our influence into the cultural conversation, not separate ourselves and say, they can all go to hell. We're just going to be over here waiting for the end to come. That's really not biblical at all. We're supposed to be in the world, but not of it. And I think that that's what makes Hannah Moore and Wilberforce so attractive, is that they were witty and charming, and they knew all kinds of people who were different than they were. And that's really my model in some ways, because they were very successful at what they did. And I think that is the biblical model, that they were holy people. They loved God, but they weren't afraid to engage with people who were very different than they were, especially in the great cause of abolishing slavery. And I think those of us who are involved in various causes, that we need to show God's love to those who are maybe different from us, but who want to be with us in the battle. And I think that that kind of what I guess maybe was I don't know if it was Chuck Colson who called it the ecumenism of the trenches. That we're in this to do good, and I think that they were willing to work with people who thought differently than they were. They befriended non-believers, and I just think that they're beautiful role models for us, and we don't get enough of that. And I think that particularly because they understood that the culture was important. And today I would say TV and radio, we're talking on radio now, these things are very, very important, for voices to be in that mix.
And it seemed, even as you mentioned to Mother Teresa a bit ago, and that's, one of the final seven you talk about, but even Hannah Moore as well, it didn't matter your sort of status in culture, right? You can high position, low position. I mean, they took opportunity, and just like Mother Teresa would do the same. I mean, she wasn't afraid to talk to anybody.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Hannah Moore was, absolutely, I should say that she was raised kind of in a middle class home, maybe upper middle class, and she rose, through her talents and her charm to mix with the high and mighty. But because of her faith, she was able to mix with the lowly, and she really spent time in the poorest villages trying to bring education to the poorest people. They didn't have religious education. They didn't have regular education. And she was really zealous to help the poor. And I think that you see God's touch on her life, that she humbled herself, and she did tremendous things. I mean, what a life. What a great life. Absolutely.
Yeah, let's take a quick call from Becky in Howard Lake before we take our break, just to let Becky say hello to Eric. Go ahead. You're on with Eric Metaxas, Becky.
Hi. Thank you. Eric, I just want to say thank you, too, for all your hard work. I just admire you and have often used the talking points you have addressed in Breakpoint and in your writings and when I engage in the culture and talk with family and friends about current issues. And I want to just encourage you in your work and say thank you and Merry Christmas.
Oh, God bless you and Merry Christmas to you. You don't know what that means to me. I say this to people all the time, that it means so much to me to get this kind of encouragement and appreciation. I am, you know, maybe unfortunately in need of it because, yeah, it's tough. And I think that I should say also that in addition to Breakpoint, I want to mention this. I'm now doing 2 hours of radio per day out of the Empire State Building. That's where I am now. And people can go to the website. It's just MetaxasTalk.com, and you can find out where to listen, or you can listen online at MetaxasTalk.com. But it's, I think it's important for us to get our various messages out there and to try to open up the conversation to include voices of faith. That's what I try to do on the radio show. I don't just interview people about faith, although, of course, I talk about that a lot. But I talk to all kinds of people about different subjects, and I so that's what I've taken on most recently, only since April, and we're on across the country. And it's, I have to tell you, it's been fun. It's actually been a lot of fun for me.
Well, we enjoy every opportunity to connect with you and love your writing, and we're going to hear more in just a moment. So let's take a quick break. We've got a couple more ladies we want to talk about. Seven Women and the Secret of Their Greatness. It's the new book from Eric Metaxas, best-selling author and radio host, and we'll get to that in just a moment. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Come and worship, come and worship, worship. Talking today about seven women and the secret of their greatness. It's the new book from Eric Metaxas, a best-selling author and a radio host. Honored to have him on with us. We hear him regularly on the Breakpoint, and so appreciate that. And have appreciated his great writing. This is another example of talking about some of the ladies in this book. Saint Maria of Paris. I was not familiar with her. She wasn't your your mainstream evangelical type person. It didn't seem like.
No. She's not Catholic. She's not evangelical. What is she? Well, I'll tell you what she is. She's a Russian Orthodox. And when I was writing the book, Joel Miller, my editor at Thomas Nelson, was saying, you know, have you thought of this one? Thought of that one? Then he mentions Maria Skubtsova, and I thought, who's that? And he goes, check it out, you might like it. So I checked it out, and I thought, wow, what a story. And I want to I was raised in the Greek Orthodox Church, and there's so many treasures in Eastern Orthodoxy, and often Catholics and evangelicals are unaware. And I said, I've got to put this woman in here because she was amazing. She was just a true intellectual genius, wrote poetry, crazy life, was a Bolshevik, and then turns away from, you know, Bolshevism and communism, becomes a Christian. All of these Russians, of course, were escaping from Russia. She ends up in Paris, where so many Russian emigres ended up. There was a large Russian emigre population in Paris. While she's in Paris, I mean, she gets married twice, divorced twice. It's like one of those crazy stories. And then finally comes to faith and gets so into it, so to speak, that she decides she wants to become a nun and spend her whole life being a mother to those, to everybody, to street people, to suffering people. And it's an incredible story. And it ends up finally that she gives her life trying to protect Jews. And she's sent to a concentration camp eventually and killed by the Nazis. But it's just so beautiful when you see the fire in this woman. What an amazing example she is to men and to women. And she was eventually made a saint by the Orthodox Church about 10 years ago, 11 years ago. So now she's Saint Maria of Paris, but most people would know her as Maria Skubtsova.
You talked about protecting those from the Nazis. Corey Ten Boom is stories in here as well. We think we know that stories are something that we maybe don't know, or that you discovered that you didn't know.
Well, I think this story of Corey Ten Boom is one of those stories that, because I've heard it over the years, I don't remember what I remember.
Sure.
Or what I forgot. You
sure.
Know, like I think the fact that she. Well, the one thing that I have to say surprised me the most about the story of Corrie ten Boom is that, you know, here she is, in case people don't know the story, she was a Dutch woman, very strong Christian family, living in Amsterdam, actually in the city of Haarlem, just outside Amsterdam. But she was a devout Christian, and her family were all clockmakers or watchmakers, so they all had that skill. And I think she was the first woman in Holland to be certified as a, you know, a master watchmaker. But she comes from a family that's not only Christian, but that 100 years before she starts speaking up for Jews, her family was already having Bible studies with Jewish people and already made this kind of spiritual connection. So it seems clear that the prayers of her ancestors, of her father, her grandfather, her great-grandfather, that they somehow came to fruition when the Nazis came, that this family had allied themselves as Christians to stand up for Jews and then lived it out in the Nazi era in a powerful way, hiding people in their home. Many people know the story of Corrie ten Boom because of the movie The Hiding Place. But she's a heroic figure. She goes to the concentration camp. Her sister dies. She lives. But eventually, you know, when she gets out, she's forgiving the people who have killed her father, her sister. You just think, wow, what a story. She really believes this stuff. And you ask yourself, do I really believe this stuff?
Yeah.
Could I forgive somebody who'd done horrible evil to people I love? Do I have the ability? You know, you realize it's not so easy, but she's a beautiful woman, wonderful person.
Well, you're talking about, you know, standing up for what's right. You know, the women that you wrote about in this book, they were willing to speak up or stand up. And in the case of Rosa Parks, they wouldn't get up. Say a word about Rosa Parks.
Well, Rosa Parks is another one of those stories that I didn't realize what a serious Christian she was. And I didn't realize what a serious role the church and Christian faith played in the civil rights movement. I mean, it's sort of in the background, but then you look into these stories. Jackie Robinson in my Seven Men book had a profound Christian faith that figured seminally in his doing what he did, breaking the color barrier in Major League Baseball. Most people don't know that Branch Rickey, who recruited him to the Brooklyn Dodgers, was a Bible-thumping Methodist who was serious, very serious about his faith, and that's one of the reasons he chose Jackie Robinson, because Jackie Robinson was serious about his faith, and he knew that I can ask this man to turn the other cheek. And when they first met, imagine that this seminal figure in the civil rights movement, when he first met with Branch Rickey, they talked about the life of Christ. There was a book called The Life of Christ by Giovanni Papini, and it tells about the Sermon on the Mount. And he opens this book up to share with Jackie Robinson that I'm going to need you to turn the other cheek. It's not enough to, you know, hit over 300 and steal bases. You've got to be able to not fight back because of your Christian faith. You know I can rely on you for that. I mean, who knew that story? It's incredible. And the same thing with Rosa Parks. You realize that it was her faith that made her, you know, the poster girl, so to speak. They could have picked other people to stand up to be the test case, but she was someone that they knew was a godly woman, a churchgoer, somebody whose faith was important to her. So she could not be vilified in the press. The whites could not say, oh, she's a woman of low morals, and she's just the opposite. And so, you know, that and her, you know, her own life as a Christian are at the very heart of why she did what she did. And so much of the civil rights movement is informed by people of serious faith. And I think that story needs to be told. So I wanted to tell that part of it in my book.
Oh, we only have about 90 seconds or so to get commented. We don't have time for the Mother Teresa full story. But I know that she was influential in your presentation to the National Prayer Breakfast in 2012.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, when I spoke in front of the president, I thought, what am I going to say? And I'm watching the different speeches over the years. Bono spoke and, you know, Tony Blair spoke. And when I watched Mother Teresa's talk, she spoke very strongly about the issue of the unborn. And I thought, I'm going to have to say something about that. If this 4'10" nun from Albania who could barely reach the microphone, you know, could speak so strongly and with authority, not in a mean way, but you could see the holiness coming out of her. I said, I feel compelled to bring that up. And so in my speech, people can watch it online or go to my website. It's just Metaxas, ericmetaxas.com or metaxastalk.com. But my speech is there because I felt it's important, even though Obama and the First Lady and Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi are right there with me on the dais, and I get to meet them and everything, but that I share my heart on this, but in a winsome way, with love, because, you know, we're all screwed up on one issue or another. And so I tried to do that. And so, yeah, Mother Teresa inspired me, and I write about that in my chapter about Mother Teresa in the book.
She was an amazing woman as well. These are women that we've just given you a little snapshot of, and I hope that you will go to the pick up the copy of the book. It's from Thomas Nelson, Seven Women and the Secret of Their Greatness. It's the latest from best-selling author Eric Metaxas, who, of course, is truly a great writer and a great communicator. And we're honored to have him with us today. Eric, we're going to get a pause to play a little audio from Angel Tree. And I know that you've been part of the Colson Center and obviously a prison fellowship very near and dear to your heart as well. Just say a word about this important outreach of prison fellowship.
Angel Tree, we are on my radio program. We're doing a campaign with Angel Tree. It is one of the most important charities there is to give to change the lives of the children of prisoners. I mean, I feel like it's an issue of obedience that we're supposed to reach out to the prisoners. One of the most beautiful ways we could do that is through Angel Tree. I cannot say anything, better about any organization than Angel Tree. So I would urge your listeners to be generous.
Now let's give a listen to today's story, and as you listen, think about ways that that you can be a part of truly making a difference in the life of a child. $73 will help reach five children with a Christmas gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their parent in prison. Listen to this.
James Browning did serious time for serious crime. Looking back, his life was beyond hope. His punishment was well-deserved.
I was a big-time drug dealer up in New York and New Jersey. I used to sell cocaine. I used to steal cars. I didn't care about people. If you said something wrong to me, you got to beat that, plain and simple. Police did not like me. I have been shot in the head, pushed off a three-story roof. I've been hit in the head with an axe. When I think about who James Browning was, he didn't need to be in the jail. He needed to be buried under the jail.
Then, one Christmas, Angel Tree volunteers delivered gifts and the gospel to his four children, introducing James to a concept that he had never known. Love. God's unconditional love.
Somebody that didn't know me, didn't know my kids, felt the love for them and love for me, and sending them gifts like, where is this coming from? What? I mean, like, how can these people care about me and care about my kids? And why? I was like, wow. And that, like, really hit me hard. And that's when I bowed down and said, God, please come into my life like that. Give me that same love that others have for me. And that's when that love started coming into me. And I asked them to accept me as I am.
With his own life completely transformed, James began to see the needs of others. While he was still in prison, he began a ministry to his fellow inmates.
We started teaching other inmates how to get themselves together before they exit out of prison so they don't have to return, how to get themselves saved, how to make sure when they get out, they get involved in church so they don't have to return.
This story is not an isolated event. As prisoners prepare for release, the single best chance they have for turning their life around is to feel, know, and accept the love of Jesus.
When I think back over the years, the best things that I've had was being involved with the ministry that God has blessed me with. I started reading the Bible, being involved with my community, and I even opened up a Christian bookstore. I can trace it all back to Angel Tree.
The best Christmas gift you can give anyone this year is to introduce them to the life-changing love of the gospel. That's the hope we're delivering with Angel Tree. Will you join us?
Here's how you can join in. You can call this toll-free number, 855-59-ANGEL. That's 855-592-6435. Or you can give online at myfaithradio.com. It's myfaithradio.com. Our Faith Radio network looking to see 1,200 children covered, taken care of, and reached through this great outreach. So far, 575 are secured. So we thank you for that, for your generosity, and hope that you will join in today with Angel Tree, 855-59-ANGEL. And thanks to Eric Metaxas for a wonderful conversation today. If you missed part of the show, you want to hear it again, you can always find the interviews posted on our website at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.